And if the question could end in a question mark, that would be awesome. Over here, yeah.
But in terms of the topic, reining in, I mean, what you've shown us tonight is probably just the tip of the iceberg. And so surely us knowing about WhatsApp or Signal is like us trying to face down a tank with a BB gun. So that's sort of one of my questions. What really can we do to prevent this? And related to that is, why is it a big deal today? 100 years ago, I mean, I'm against it, but 100 years ago, you know, the telephone operator with a headphone plugging in the cords could listen to every one of our verbal conversations literally. We didn't get upset about that. So what's changed about our society? But my real question is this.
So your third question is this.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, okay. You can choose one in fairness. Okay. Just that was a reflection of your presentation. My real question I came for tonight is, I have a sense that there's no uproar in our society about this because we're somewhat buying into the message that all this is done to keep us safe. And so unless we can turn the tide of our beliefs that in fact this intrusiveness is a danger to our democracy and a danger to our society, there really won't be more of an uproar about it. So that's, if you only choose one of the questions, address that.
I think we can do all three. I don't think that's a problem. Look, so I'm not going to come here and give a talk that scares you for no reason and leaves you without the feeling like you can do something about it. And I don't want to tell you, here are these token small things that you can do that won't really do anything, but it'll at least make you feel good. I want to give you concrete advice that will actually make a difference. And the issue is surveillance, at its core, it comes down to the economics. If the government really, really cares about you, and they think that you're a really bad person or you're a particularly interesting person, they will burn all the resources they have to get you. And there's nothing you can really do to stop that. If they really care about you, they will send people to your house and put microphones under your bed and hack into your camera. They'll do everything. But most of us aren't that important. I suspect that no one in this room is important enough that the government would spend $1 million to spy on you. So the question is, well, are you interesting enough that they would spend $10 to spy on you? Or $50? Or $100? And so if we can raise the cost of surveillance so that it costs $1,000 or $10,000 or $100,000 for them to spy on you, well, agencies have limited budgets. They don't have the resources to spy on every American when surveillance is expensive. But right now, surveillance is so damn cheap that it's really a question of collect it now and filter it later. And so when you use tools like Signal or WhatsApp or iMessage, and you know, I personally would prefer that you use something like Signal because it's open source. And I think open source is important when it comes to trust and security. But even if you just use the tool that's built into your iPhone, you make surveillance more difficult, you make it more expensive, and suddenly, you know, you might be too expensive for them to spy on because they don't, you know, because you're not going to be shining in that pile of data. And then the third question, I forgot what it was because there were so many things.
That was a question about uproar. Okay. And why isn't there more uproar? And I think that it's a really valid concern. Ultimately, you know, a lot of what you think of when you think about surveillance is fairly abstract. The impact it has on our community is hard to quantify. And there's certainly things you can point to, impacts on free speech and people's willingness to engage in controversial issues. But, you know, I think the reality is that people tend to respond to these things when there are tangible effects that they have. I was talking with Chris earlier about how red light cameras are something that there's a lot of uproar about because there is this tangible impact of, hey, I got this ticket for this thing and there was, you know, no person saw me do it. It just happened to be a camera on a street corner. In the same way, issues of hacking, I think, for a lot of people are intangible, but then when you have stories about, you know, schools installing spyware on the computers that they give to kids, all of a sudden, you know, there's uproar and parents get involved and concerned. So it's really a matter of kind of finding those good stories to illustrate these issues and distilling the kind of large abstract concepts into ones that, you know, people can grasp easily. And it's not easy.
Over here.
About a year and a half ago, there was a tour about big data, the book. And I'd like you to comment on your observations of privatization, of ubiquitous observation, and the algorithms that sort out that information very cost effectively, have nothing to do with the government, but the government uses that data to further their ends.
So there's a law professor whose work I really like. His name is Paul Ohm. He's at Georgetown Law School, and he talks about this idea of the database of ruin. He says that there's a database somewhere that has information about all of us, that if it were revealed to the world, if our loved ones or our colleagues saw that information, it would be disastrous to us. And for all intents and purposes, these databases of ruin have existed for decades, but we had practical obscurity because they were too difficult to collect and to collate and to link to us. What terrifies me isn't that all this data has been collected, because it's been collected for years. What terrifies me is that it's now being linked. And the scariest thing that's coming down the pipe isn't big data, it's actually facial recognition. Because the face is the identifier that collects all these things. And you know, I'm now in a loving relationship, but you know, a couple years ago I was single and I had an online dating profile. And you know, every once in a while, maybe someone, a colleague from work, would stumble across my profile. But for the most part, I had my work personality and I had my online dating personality, and they were separate. And we're rapidly moving into a direction where, you know, you're browsing the web and you're looking at a dating site and you see someone interesting and you right-click on their photo and you say, who is this? And it suddenly tells you their name and their address and where they work and how much they earn and all the research papers they wrote when they were undergrads and all this other stuff. And I don't think our society is wired right now. We're not preparing ourselves and protecting ourselves with that kind of technology in mind. And I think many of us are going to be in for a really unpleasant surprise when all this data from disparate databases is linked through the unique identifier that you cannot change and cannot run away from, which is your face.
All right. I have a Twitter question. So what do you expect from social media or cloud companies with regards to avoidance of surveillance? I think this is particularly interesting because of some of the work you've done in terms of poking and prodding certain companies to, you know, bolster their security mechanisms.
So I have a love-hate relationship with many of the companies and many of their lawyers. You know, it's really difficult to get the companies to do things that are not aligned with their business interests. I can pressure companies to roll out encryption. I can pressure companies to update and upgrade their security, because ultimately that's just a question of money. But getting them to keep less data ultimately hits their business model. And so getting a company like Facebook to retain less data, getting a company like Google to provide encrypted communications that they themselves cannot access, that's a really tough ask, and I've not been successful in that area. You know, right now, the dominant business model, with the exception of a few companies, is you get these services for free, and in exchange you get these great apps and tools, and you know, the way they make money is by collecting and mining data. And realistically, I don't think that we can expect those companies to change their data collection practices and thus their surveillance practices, because if you have it, the government will come and ask for it. I don't think we can expect that to change until these companies find another way to make money. You know, in Google's case, you know, Google's trying to find a million different ways to make money, whether it's, you know, solar power or self-driving cars or space, the balloons with Wi-Fi that are flying over continents. Google's clearly like looking for other ways to make money, but as long as Google's lifeblood is advertising, I think we can only expect them to go so far. Again, Google has done probably more than any tech company in the last 2 years to secure themselves post-Snowden, but that's been to secure the connection between the customer and Google and the connection between Google and Google, but they haven't locked themselves out of our conversations. And that's really a question of business models more than anything else.
I think we're at left now.
If we're going to try to get information from if we're going to try to find out what local agencies are getting money, what agencies do we write to in the federal government for FOIA requests to find out where those grants are going? And a second question, no lecture, just a question, is what is the ACLU doing about smart meters? Because that's very significant privacy invasion, as well as health and other issues.
So on the first question, the main agencies that issue grants are DHS, Department of Homeland Security, and DOJ. Within DHS, it's FEMA that is the grant-giving agency, not because FEMA is a surveillance agency, but FEMA is the most equipped agency within DHS to write large checks very quickly. After an emergency, they're really good at giving out money, and so they are the de facto grant giver at DHS. and then you also have the DOD, the military, who provides surplus, you will find that all of those agencies take a long, long time to respond to FOIA requests. And so I actually encourage you to file your state-level equivalent FOIA request with your own local agencies who are the recipient of the grant funds, because they will probably turn those around faster than the feds.
Yeah, so for example, the Stingray that Tacoma has that that Chris was referring to earlier in his talk, various public records requests to the Tacoma Police Department turned up, you know, the grant applications with FEMA, with DHS, and often, it's much easier, much quicker. Our state-level public records laws are much more liberal and permissive than FOIA, so using the Public Records Act where possible is will get you quicker results.
And then on the smart meter question, because I know there are people in the audience who care really deeply about smart meters. Traditionally, the police could go to the power company and find out some information about your power usage. They could get information on a monthly basis to figure out, you know, whether you were using more electricity than your neighbors. But it was monthly. It wasn't hourly or at a minute-by-minute level. Obviously, now that marijuana is legal here, I guess you guys don't have as much of a concern about the police trying to figure out who's using more power than their neighbors. But power data doesn't just reveal whether you have a bunch of grow lamps in your house. There's some fantastic research by a professor at the University of Washington here showing that individual appliances in homes have unique fingerprints, electronic fingerprints, that if you have two models of the same television, someone watching the power usage outside the home can actually tell which of those two TVs was turned on. Crazy, crazy stuff. I think that, you know, the courts have not done enough to protect power data because, there are categories of data that get the lowest protection under the law. So banking records and power, sort of traditional things that have been obtained with subpoenas, which law enforcement agencies in many parts of the country can just write themselves. I think that power data can reveal activities inside the home, and I think that what takes place in the home should receive the highest protection under the law. That's not happening right now. And so I would like to see more protections for that, particularly as computer scientists and electrical engineers reveal just how useful and sensitive this data actually is.
And echoing some of that, I think that there's also very serious concerns about the collaborations between public utilities and private companies in sharing this data. I mean, talking about linkability of information, nuanced information about what goes inside your home in the hands of Google obviously means something very different than just your utility company having that information. So, you know, state-level regulations that prevent utility companies from sharing this information for commercial purposes or wholesale is obviously something that is critical to preserving some of the balance of privacy here.
Right. What is the ACLU doing now with smart meters?
So at the national level, I don't think we're doing much. I think this is a state level issue because rules are very different in states. I know where there's been the most success has actually been in California, where the ACLU and EFF worked together to institute data security rules for smart meters. And one of the things we were able to get was mandatory reports published by the power companies every year revealing how many requests they get from law enforcement agencies. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, the police in San Diego submit an order of magnitude more law enforcement requests than any other law enforcement agency in the state of California. Why, we don't know, but at least we now have that data. But that's where we've seen the most success. I don't know, what's happening here.
Thank you.
So I have another Twitter question. So perfect content cryptography does little for metadata, which is often incredibly sensitive. Do you have any long-term metadata strategies, or do you want to talk about that issue at all?
All right, so encryption can protect the contents of your communication. If you use iMessage or FaceTime, the authorities, if they haven't hacked your phone, they shouldn't be able to learn what you're saying. But if you call an abortion clinic, someone can probably guess what you're calling them about. If you call a suicide hotline and you're on the phone for an hour, it doesn't really matter what you say. It's the fact that you're calling that suicide hotline for an hour that's sensitive. And, the technical community, the computer security and privacy community, we don't have great tools for protecting metadata, with the exception of services that hide your information by routing you through other servers. There's a great service that I recommend called Tor, that you can use to browse the web anonymously, but Tor is a bit slow. It's fine for browsing the web, but it's not great for something like a real-time video call, video chat or an audio chat. The latency is too high, and so we don't have a good way of doing low latency, you know, real-time conversations that hide your metadata. Separately, there's no way that we know right now for your cell phone to communicate with a cell tower such that the cell tower won't know where you are. And so over time, we're probably going to move in a direction where we have more and more encryption, which means the police are going to get less and less information about what you're saying, but they're still going to have a huge amount of data about who you're talking to, when you're talking to them, how often you're talking to them, how long the conversation lasted, and where you were when you said that. And that's enough data to hang lots of people. Over here.
I just had a couple of comments on the point about lack of uproar. I'd point you back to Aldous Huxley said that stuff in the 50s about we're luxuriating ourselves to death. So it's the opposite of a totalitarian state, but same net effect in the end. I had a couple questions. One was, could you comment on the recent GSM keys theft? And secondly, you missed one big kahuna in town that's called Amazon, which just came out with a nice product called Echo, which sits and listens to everything in your house. And
so there's only so many kahunas I can tackle in one talk. So for those of you who don't know, I'll try and summarize the SIM card thing in like a minute. There's a small chip, smaller than a postage stamp, in most of your cell phones, and that holds an encryption key that only your phone and the cell phone company is supposed to know. And increasingly, modern phones use not amazing encryption, not awful encryption, somewhere sort of in the middle, to protect the communications from your phone to the cell tower. But if you know the encryption key, you can decrypt the calls. And one of the stories that The Intercept, which is Glenn Greenwald's organization, put out a few weeks ago, revealed that GCHQ, which is the British intelligence agency, hacked into the largest manufacturer of these SIM cards and stole hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of SIM cards, of SIM card encryption keys. And so this is hundreds of thousands of keys in Somalia and other countries, but this company, Gemalto, provides SIM cards for AT&T and T-Mobile and Sprint and Verizon, and they also have the $175 million contract for the smart passports that we have in the U.S., you know, the little antenna thing in your passport that you're not able to bend. And so there are some really interesting and troubling open questions right now about how secure your phone calls are and whether AT&T and T-Mobile and Verizon and Sprint are going to recall the SIM cards and issue new ones, or whether they're going to leave us all out in the lurch. That's, you know, yet another reason why I don't think we should trust the phone networks to provide us with confidentiality. I think we should use apps that go over the data connection, like iMessage and FaceTime and WhatsApp and Signal, because I don't trust the phone companies, and they have a really bad track record in protecting privacy and security.
And to follow up that, I think there's also a very real concern that, like money, like equipment, those, you know, compromised SIM cards could trickle down from the NSA to the FBI to local law enforcement to some extent. And so it may not just be the NSA or GCHQ or, you know, other kind of foreign intelligence agencies that have access to your keys, the keys to your communications. It could also theoretically be federal and local law enforcement.
Thank you so much for all of the work that you're doing here, especially exposing making it transparent what's going on. I'm really concerned about the solutions, though, as I don't think that hiding is enough. It appears that the EU may be well ahead of us with things like the EU Data Directive. Are U.S. laws really enough, or do we need proactive user rights that give us unalienable rights to view data, to correct data, to have data deleted and removed even from private corporations, and not used against us?
I mean, if you're asking me what I would like in an ideal world, I think all of those things are fantastic. I live in Washington, D.C., which is one of the least productive cities in the United States. Nothing gets done where I live. And so, you know, if you're waiting for Congress to pass legislation that will give you European-style rights, you're going to be waiting for a while. That's why, you know, so the ACLU has a lobbying office in Washington, D.C., and we have full-time lobbyists who are in Congress every day trying to convince members to pass legislation that would protect your emails, protect your location data to rein in the NSA. And they work really hard, and they don't get paid enough money, but realistically, it's not going to happen anytime soon. And what's probably going to happen, you know, so there's the authority that the NSA used to collect everyone's cell phone or call detail records is going to expire this year. And what's probably going to happen is they're going to wait until like midnight the night before it expires and say, oh my goodness, terrorists, we got to renew this thing. It's an emergency. And then they'll get what they want. I don't want that to happen, but that, looking by what's happened in previous years, they do very little until it's absolutely like the last minute, and then they just rush something through. It's for that reason, the reason, you know, that people in DC, the political process in DC is so paralyzed, that, you know, that's why I believe in technology. Technology has the potential to provide basic privacy protections where law and policy lag behind. And, you know, when a company rolls out default end-to-end encryption to 500 million users, it doesn't matter what the rules are, doesn't matter whether the police need a warrant or a lesser court order or a higher court order, now those communications are effectively off-limits to not just the U.S. government, not just the FBI and local law enforcement, the NSA, but to every tin-pot authoritarian regime that doesn't respect human rights everywhere in the world. And so technology is just such a major game-changer. But we don't decide the technology that we use in many cases. We're reliant on these mega corporations that provide the instant messaging apps and the communications tools and the smartphones. And so, you know, we got to get these folks to play along and we got to pressure them.
And there has been some state legislation that's moved the needle as well. In California in particular, where so many of these companies are and all of them have major presences, there have been kind of industry or sector-specific laws that have said, hey, you have to use encryption in this context, or you have to provide users with the right to delete, you know, their profiles in this context. And that's actually had a fairly large impact, because when California says it or another prominent state says it, you find these companies just do it for everyone, right? They roll out features that comply with the law, and you have that technological impact for, you know, all their users.
Thank you. So over here.
Thanks for all the work you're doing. I just wanted to ask again if you can talk a little bit more about Amazon. I've read multiple times about a multi-billion dollar agreement that they have with the CIA that involves cloud computing. You know, Amazon is here locally, and so I think they would be maybe somewhat responsive if members of the local community sort of targeted them for a protest or whatever.
Sure.
So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that. And then just secondly, can you address the argument that you mentioned that the FBI and others make, that they are only going after bad guys, and that all of this technology, all of this surveillance is targeted specifically to bad people, and therefore it doesn't affect everyone else? When I talked to FBI spokesperson about the impersonating an AP reporter, her response was incredibly flippant, and it was basically, well, we could impersonate anyone if we were trying to get a bad guy. This kid was calling in bomb threats. You know, we could have just impersonated a dentist in order to get him to install this spyware on his computer. So how do you respond to that mindset on the part of all these agencies?
So those are excellent questions. So I regularly communicate with the lawyers at all the big tech companies, and I've hit a wall with Amazon. It's just really difficult to reach the right people there. In the last, you know, couple years, particularly post-Snowden, companies that were never transparent, like Apple, have been much more transparent. They publish reports now every twice a year revealing how many surveillance requests they get. Yahoo, Facebook, Microsoft, all are publishing transparency reports. Zero from Amazon. And, you know, it's not just requests for user data, it's requests for data stored by Amazon's cloud computing clients, right? Why would you go to some dinky startup when you can go to Amazon and get data about the services that are being provided through their cloud computing services? And so, you know, I think Amazon has really escaped the spotlight. I think, you know, maybe we dropped the ball on that. Maybe we should have been focusing more of our attention on them. I think it's about time that Amazon published a transparency report. I think that they should do that. We'd love to see them follow the lead of other companies and adopt progressive policies like notifying users about surveillance requests unless they're prohibited from doing so via gag order. That's something that every company could do, but very few actually do. Amazon has a massive reach. And then, you know, they provide cloud computing services to many federal agencies, including the CIA. That doesn't really terrify me. I mean, Dell sells laptops and computers to government agencies. That doesn't make them a surveillance company, but I definitely think Amazon could be more upfront about the kinds of surveillance requests they receive. You know, for the second question about, well, we're just spying on bad guys, I think it's important to differentiate between domestic law enforcement and foreign intelligence. In the domestic law enforcement front, there are several technologies like the Stingray that, although they say they're only using them to catch bad guys, the technologies are overbroad by their very nature. You cannot turn on a Stingray and identify one phone. You turn it on and you get the cell phone serial numbers of everyone in the room. And their response is, well, yeah, we don't really save that information. We might collect it, we might send signals into your living room, into your car, into your purse, but don't worry, we're not looking at it after. And, you know, my response to that is, well, you know, if they put a video camera in your bedroom and said, well, don't worry, it's not turned on, or we'll only turn it on if you're a bad guy, I don't think many of us would be comfortable with that. That's not an excuse. On the foreign intelligence surveillance side, it's actually worse because, you know, I think post-Snowden, the response from the government has been, well, look, there are these really bad people out there, you know, we need to spy on them, terrorists, you know, that kind of thing. But what the Snowden documents have shown is, in fact, a lot of the surveillance that the U.S. government does and its partners like the British and the Canadians do isn't aimed at terrorists, it's aimed at people who are interesting. And interesting is way broader. That can be, you know, we want to spy on, you know, the opposing negotiators in some trade treaty. We want to listen to the telephone calls of foreign leaders. We want to hack into the computers of engineers at Belgacom, not because we believe this Belgian phone company is a terrorist outfit, but because they provide telephone service to people who are interesting. And so the logic of the NSA and GCHQ now basically means that any engineer, any computer, any system administrator, or someone who does technology at any global infrastructure company, anyone that makes any technology that interesting people might use is fair game. And I think that's really messed up. And I mean, I used to be a sysadmin, so this is like a personal thing, but I don't think it's cool. I don't think we signed up. I certainly never saw the debate where the NSA said, oh yeah, by the way, we're going to stalk engineers online. We're going to follow their every communication online and then deliver malware targeting them because we want to get into their employers. I didn't sign up for that, and I didn't agree to that, and Congress certainly never passed legislation approving that. And I think those kinds of activities undermine the very legitimacy of what the NSA is doing. It's one thing to spy on bad guys, but every engineer in the world shouldn't be fair game.
All right, we have time for one last question.
As far as smart meters, I believe that Port Angeles, Washington has restricted their use, so maybe we should start on the local level. My question is about using Linux operating system. I can dual boot my used laptop into Windows or Linux. From a privacy standpoint, how much does that help?
I've been using Linux since I was 12 years old. I like Linux. I use it on my computer. We are a Linux-friendly employer at the ACLU. I think that, you know, having choice is always a good thing, and given the revelations that we've seen in the last year, particularly in the last year, I'm starting to have less and less trust in closed-source software and what the Linux community is doing, particularly the Debian, which is a group within Linux. They're working on something called reproducible builds, which is a way of knowing that the code that you're download or the binary that you're downloading came from the source code that developers put online. And I want more trust in the software that I use, and I think open source software like Linux provides you with that trust. It's not a guarantee, but it's definitely better than trusting something that came from some outfit that I have no way of inspecting.
So I just wanted to say thanks to Chris for flying out here from D.C. and spending this time with us, and thanks to everyone in the room for coming visiting. Have a good night.